it's so interesting the way associations evolve. We have a whole book of how to do everything. And in spite of having a whole book how to do everything, we're still not sure. There's still things that come up. And do you remember how to do that? What did we do last time? So it takes a lot of skill and tact in order to work with each other and work out these little naughty things about how to do things. Because it becomes it can become very intense. I remember when I first went to another session with another teacher, and I just felt indignant. They were doing things all wrong. It just didn't feel right. There isn't any right way to do it. It's just what we all agree to, and that's what makes things go smoothly. Do be the flow that Beata is talking about. That if we all know what to do and allow each other enough space to have it all work together, then it does go. And it's a kind of pleasure in it that's almost luxurious. We hardly ever have that kind of ease in ordinary life. Because we're mostly dealing with people we don't know or don't know very well, and so we can't take for granted that everything is going to be worked out in some way. It's much harder to do, but it's our work also as we bring ourselves into the world to be able to truly meet who we meet each time and work it out. The third and fourth day, my old friend Sonia used to call it the time when it feels like we're in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people. And what are we doing here anyway? It can be very irritating. It's natural because we are becoming more familiar with each other and with our own proclivities, the things that we want and like. We're also very caught in our practice in that stepping back and turning around. We become much more sensitive to sound and taste and all of the senses. It all becomes very vivid, and some of them we like and some of them we don't like. So it's a chance to experience two sides of ourself. The Zazen side, trying to make itself comfortable as life, as living, eating, sleeping, washing. We think of Zazen only. We just sit. But of course, we do all those other things, and we do them all together. And so we slowly begin to develop a way of being with each other. One of the old teachers said, mind cannot objectify, thinking cannot describe, just step back and carry on and avoid offending anyone you face. I think that's a wonderful way of describing how to be together in Sesshin. We don't necessarily like each other. We don't have to like each other. We can't. We're not made that way. We can love each other. In the Dharma, love is universal. At the very center of us is love. But liking is something else. And if we confuse those two, cultivate dislike in the presence of a dharmic situation like this, it creates for the disliking person a lot of trouble. And so we work together with it. We work on ourselves. And I always think, at least in my life, I'm just full of apology most of the time. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. For whatever. As they say, it's just one mistake after another. And we can't expect much more than that. We really can't. So our high ideals are important, but if we hold them without forgiveness and a realistic assessment of what it is, how we actually can be in this world, it makes it too difficult. So much of life is about bumping up against those ideals and failing. We fail our kindergarten teacher. We fail our parents, our teachers. And, of course, we're conditioned to see ourselves as a failure. And in truth, there's no such thing. We do the best we can. Some people are more insightful than others and seem to be doing better. But we don't even know how to measure better. It's all relative. It's all contingent. One of the things that pleases me about this practice, especially this so-called just sitting, is that it can be done by anybody. It can be done anywhere and at any time. It's not special to the Zendo. It's not special to the corner that we set up in our house. It's not for a special Sesshin time only. It means that we, as Dogen said, we don't have to be smart or highly educated. We don't have to be really good at it, because we don't know what really good at it means. It's free. We don't have to join a temple. We don't have to wear fancy clothes. We don't have to eat special food, a special diet. It's totally, totally free. Suzuki Roshi talked about having a very, very wide field to keep your animal in, your horse or your ox. Make a very big field for it. Give it freedom, space, a big sky overhead. That too is Shikantaza. Koban used to say how grateful he was to Zazen. I think some of us feel the way he did, that it saved our life. To come to this, or to have been come to in some way. To be allowed to accept our life. To be allowed not to have to live up to some high standard. To be allowed to truly experience what's happening. Rather than creating our own little play and then being disappointed that it doesn't work out. It never works out. It always turns into something else. Usually something much more interesting, even though we often don't think so. It's like Hak Win when he was accused of having made a baby and just took it in. And then they came back and said, oh, we made a mistake 7 years later. Sorry, sorry. You weren't the father after all. Okay. He gave the baby back. That would make a great television drama with lots of stuff going on. But he just adjusted. And so much of our life, just as it is in Zazen, is just adjusting. Going with what's going on. Being what's going on. And learning from it. Deeply, deeply learning from it. Without judging ourselves. Koban used to give an example of, like Hakuin's, of two people in the desert with one bottle of water, just enough to get to the village they're heading for. And he said, a true bodhisattva gives the bottle to the person she's with. Or two people are heading to a very narrow door, which will lead to something wonderful. And there's only room for one person to get through. And a bodhisattva lets the other one go through. This is really hard. It sounds so nice. It sounds lovey-dovey, but it's really hard. We know it as parents. If we have children, that's what it is to raise children. You give them the space and the time and everything that they need. Dogen in the Tenzo Kyokun recommended a parental mind for all of us. a magnanimous mind, a great big field, a parental mind, and a joyous mind. The joyous mind is the mind of Zazen. So we're developing a lot of energy. You probably feel it. When I was young, and practicing at Hidden Villa, doing Sesshin with Koban, I would, during the breaks, just walk straight up this almost vertical mountain, Elephant Mountain, which rose right behind the youth hostel where we had our Sesshins. I just felt this tremendous energy, and whew, I'd go all the way up to the top of that mountain, through the poison oak and everything, without realizing what it was, what it is. It's very, very helpful. This is us. This is what we are. This is life energy. Did you samadhi? And it's easy to distract ourselves and leak it. It easily kind of slip away. Talking is a very good way of getting rid of some of it, because it begins to feel like we're filling up with something, and it's not entirely comfortable. So talking is a real good way of releasing that tension. And of course, walking to the top of mountains at top speed is another way. There are lots of ways. Or just starting to think a lot and try to analyze and figure everything out. That's a good way. Or my old friend Charlie Ewing, who built a whole house in his mind while he was sitting Zazen one session. He bought all the supplies, figured it all out, laid the foundation. It's a way of sort of putting it all off. So I would encourage you to feel the energy, and appreciate it and protect it. You don't have to do anything. It will do you. It is doing us. It is us. So Dogen said, and this is, I've quoted part of this to you, he said, realization is simply just sitting Zazen. We think sitting Zazen, we're going to get realization. But we ourselves are a Buddha as we sit. The sitting itself is Buddha activity. So when we say, I don't know why I'm here, what am I doing here? It's because Buddha activity doesn't know itself in the same way. We call ourselves a person or a self. But Buddha itself is the action itself. And the action itself feels just totally natural. Even though we wonder, it's so amazing that we find ourselves in this activity, expressing in this way. He said, "Great assembly, do you want to hear the reality of just sitting, which is the Zen practice of dropping off body and mind?" After a pause, he said, "Mind cannot objectify it. Thinking cannot describe it. Just step back and carry on and avoid offending anyone you face. At the ancient dock, the wind is. The wind and moon are cold and clear. At night, the boat floats peacefully in the land of lapis lazuli." That last little bit of poem is from Hongzhi. So we're not doing concentration practices. We're not staring at a candle or watching the incense smoke going up. Those are wonderful practices. We're not focusing on chopping a carrot unless we're working in the kitchen and then we're doing kitchen samadhi. But in the Zendo, we're doing the sitting samadhi, which is just sitting. It's so simple, it's really hard. So, are there questions? Malcolm?
Your last phrase sums it up so beautifully. It's so simple, yet so hard.
Yeah.
Just not finding, I mean, for me, this, you're quite right. I mean, this, why am I here? Who are these people? This is absolutely crazy. My car's really only, that's just the hill, you know? And I know where the keys are.
Everybody's thinking the same thing.
So,
hang in there. There's more.
Yes.
Not offending others. And sometimes I feel like that happens before I open my mouth, but then quite frequently it happens the minute I open my mouth. And yet I don't have time, you know, I have all this time to sit and think about it. But somehow I think that would be not called for. So it seems to me that it's going to have to just work in me so that once in a while I'll say the right thing.
That's right. And one help is to give it space so that it's like answering emails. If you answer right away, it often is not what you would say later. And so it helps to wait even 3 breaths before you reply. And that gives your mind-body a chance to adjust to what's actually going on. And sometimes if you feel it won't be exactly right speech, you can excuse yourself and say you'll come back later and address it. That helps me more than anything, because I'm slow and I need time to know what is the right thing to do or what feels is the right thing. Sometimes that's a mistake too, and then we have to eat it. you know, but find ways of giving yourself enough, excuse me, enough time and space so that you don't just bang into something unexpectedly. Because that's painful on both sides. Kathy, I didn't see you back there. I don't have my glasses on.
It's okay. You know, I wonder sometimes, like, why is it so difficult to sit and keep my mind on just, you know, breathing? When the whole concept of this whole practice has been, like you said, a lifesaver for me. You know, there was, when I broke my femur and I just lost everything. And I just, you know, my business, my home, you know, everything. And I just thought, I will never recover from this. And I haven't recovered from it in any other way except for in here. And I just am able to just be here and now. And it's such a beautiful thing. And yet every time I come in here and try to just keep my mind, you know.
You can't keep your mind.
And while I keep reeling it back, and you know, it's like you said, it's hard. It's so simple and it's hard.
Right.
And it's kind of a contradiction because the whole practice has been such a lifesaver.
Yes, right. Well, you'll never stop thinking.
Yeah.
You know, that's what appears to be a problem, because your thinking just keeps squirting out of you.
Mm-hmm.
And even people who've been sitting for a long time and have apparently very few thoughts, there's still thinking going on, and it's measurable with EKG and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make an effort to stop it, if you work at it with your thinking, trying to stop your thinking with your thinking, it just makes it more. Yeah. So if you accept it and say, you know, be my guest, thank you very much, and just stay with yourself. Just be what you are right there. Sit with dignity, sometimes they say. Take your seat and sit with dignity, whatever is going on, and be your whole body, not just your head. This is just a small part of all of us. So let the whole thing sit and breathe in a dignified way.
I'm so glad you just said that, because it seems like my mind is anything but dignified, and yet, you know, your body is really quite miraculous and wonderful and above all that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Our mind is everything. Our mind includes all the worst of human being and all the best. And, of course, when we sit down with it after a lifetime of ignoring what's going on, it's a shock to see how much of the worst we carry in us. It's the really hard part of practice. The beginning part of practice, because it's such a surprise. I'm such a nice person. Maybe so, maybe not. so it's that's an adjustment already. and then cultivate the good parts. You know, dignity is about carrying one's whole self in the world as a kind of blessing. So that part we can choose. We can't choose some of the things we think. And that can be very painful and distressing. But we can choose how we enact our life, which actions we will perform. And that's up to us. So it means a very big effort to be mindful at all times of how our mind is tending. And I always think it's a kind of drunken stagger between one side and then the other, and sometimes we find the middle, and there's some kind of, but in life itself it's not easy, because we get, you know, all toughened up, and then we get all soft and gentle. And but the reality is to know your own mind really, really well, and then find ways of doing, enacting your Buddha life in a way that's helpful for all, to do no harm.
This brings to mind, for me, when I am experiencing those parts of myself that I'm not too excited about, I started using that practice that you talked about in the last day or two about smiling. And just saying, oh, there it is again. And smiling, but smiling through the whole body, you know, so that you just really can accept it and let it be in its own space. Mm-hmm. And it helps a great deal for me.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Zach?
Yeah. Something I still find myself getting caught by a lot, even though I know how silly it is like you mentioned, judging one way or the other, but what's been coming up for me a lot more lately is judging my practice as bad as compared to somebody else's as good, mm-hmm. and falling for the outward appearance. You know, you like look over at the person, you get a little glimpse of the person next to you, and you're like, man, the practice is immaculate. Mm-hmm. Practically like radiating. and I'm over here just faking it. Hard one. So I was wondering if you had any advice for me or anyone else in there who's like that, for evening that out.
Damn, I was thinking the same thing. About
yeah. Join the club.
Good fake. Had me fooled.
Yeah, that's what they say. If you don't know how, just pretend. Mm-hmm. You'll get it. We're all faking it. In one way, we really don't know what we're doing. It's like kids thinking the grown-ups know what they're doing. And then you get to be a grown-up, and good Lord! even the most powerful, brilliant people don't really know. We're all blundering. And at the same time, we're being carried and held in a way that creates this life that we are living. And so it takes some trust in it, some real faith, and a real study to see what's actually going on, and not worry about yourself so much. Because you'll be okay. Just attend to the practice and do it, and then do it again, and then do it some more. And it doesn't stop. There's no beginning, really, and there's no ending. We never get it. We're always in the course of getting it. And that's the important part of it. So you're doing great. And you're an encouragement to all the rest of us, too. Mm-hmm. A big one. Mm-hmm. So don't forget that either. Of course, the other side of what you're feeling is that you can start feeling that you're pretty hot stuff. And who are these people you're sitting with? We don't know a thing, right? It goes both ways. Comparison is a really, really tough thing. With the SPOT program, the priest training program that Grace Shireson is doing, we had a whole weekend on this very subject, because it's so easy to get into that mode of comparing oneself to others, either the high or the low way. And either way is not so helpful, because it means that we're not seeing clearly what the situation is. We can't judge, especially around practice, we can't judge. We can feel for others, and we can help them. But if we start judging them, then we're turning it into something entirely different. So it's very, very helpful to be aware of that judgmental mind. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Jane?
But don't judge it.
Don't judge it. Yeah, just let it be. We're all doing it. Debbie?
I've been thinking about judgment quite a bit in relationship to practice. It's funny. I'm noticing that I've these judgments that I've been having in my head about, like, whether I'm doing it right, that I don't even, when a thought comes into my mind, I realize that I, like, jump away from it, I shouldn't be doing this, kind of. I've been doing it for years, and I never noticed it until recently. It seems as though my mind just judges things without asking. I don't know if you have any.
It's a survival thing. We have that ability. It's part of our genius as human beings, our ability to think and to create judgments and know whether something is hot and dangerous or cool and will save our life. Or good to eat and not good to eat, or a dangerous person or a not dangerous person. I mean, on that level, it's a part of our lizard mind and more. So it's important not to throw it away, but to stay open-minded. I always think that if we could just meet each thing that comes before us with a question, what is this that's now before me? Who is this? Tell me your truth. That gives the other, so-called other, an opportunity to open up, perhaps. And it gives you an opportunity to really be with them, whoever they are, first. And without jumping to conclusions. That's what prejudice is. Prejudging is already having a judgment without even knowing. And our attention that we always talk about, trying to pay attention, is to know what's here. And not to jump to conclusions about anything. then we're whole and everything else is whole. It's not little bits and pieces of ideas. Ideas are so cheap. We've got a million of them. And finding that, discovering the truth of things is so simple that we overlook it often. So I think you had a really important insight. It helps to see it. Yeah. Hello. Bye, Jeff.
I was thinking about how much I'm enjoying this session, and I always like the talks because we can all relate because we have a very similar experience. And then, you know, when it's going really good, I find myself wondering, like, well, wow, you know, why is this going really good, and how did I create this? You know? And it always tends to happen around the fourth day for me, or it has for the at least the last couple of years when I do session, where I end up like falling into this place where, but the only way I can describe those like pure moments where there's like the non-judgment and just kind of as close as I can be or get to pure presence is surrender to pure faith with pure faith to surrender. And I think that, you know, those words before for me were had a lot of Christian connotations and a lot of like faith and devotion type stuff, but I struggle, you know, if there is a struggle, it's it just comes to a point to where there's this surrender. And like I like how you mentioned faith, because I don't think we talk about that a lot in our practice too much. Or at least it was hard for me to relate to. But I think that's really, you know, for me really valuable, because when I find myself in those points, then it's like I don't know, and it's okay to not know. Yeah. You know, and actually that's what saves me.
Yes,
you know? That's the only thing that saves me is not knowing, you know, and surrendering to that. The other thing that I was going to say was, you know, we were talking about our actions, and that we have the ability to choose how we act and kind of create that mind, you know. And it's fascinated me through my practice, like really seeing that, you know, there's this phenomenon here called abhijja, and I can't figure them out because there's no one story to them. There's no, like, this is who he is and why he's this way, you know? The more I look into it, it's like he's this way for all these reasons, and reasons that I'm not even aware of, and they keep on presenting themselves to me. So I find whenever I start to judge someone or what someone does, I get back in that conundrum where it's like, I couldn't possibly understand this person. Mm-hmm. I couldn't possibly understand who they are, what they've been through to make them react this way, or, you know? And then I fall back into, okay, the not knowing again. So I guess, you know, a good thing to do for me, anyway, is to start off with surrendering.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. So. And keep climbing the mountain. Mm-hmm. And faith, the way we talk about it in ordinary terms, is confidence. Confidence. Fidence is the Latin for faith. So real confidence, real sense of autonomy in this mystery that we call abhijja, is real trust in that, in what carries it, is what faith is. So we don't have faith in something other, except in the sense of carrying how we carry our intention, even in not knowing, how we carry our not knowing as complete confidence in the whole thing as it is. You know, in the Lotus Sutra, it says Avalokiteshvara is everywhere and responding to every cry. Mm-hmm. So you can think of it in terms like that and see how, although we think we're just these isolated bits and are doing it all ourselves, we're being held by everything. The chair is holding us up, and the floor is holding us up, and the room is warm because of, I mean, those things too are infinite in number. All the causes and conditions are so vast and dynamic that we look at it in awe, or appreciate it in awe, and carry that confidence through it, as it, by it, for it. That's the source of our action, is that deep trust. Even though we can't exactly name it.
What would you say, you know, it seems like in Zen, and I can understand this, the value to this approach is that we don't try to control our circumstances or the content of our experience. But what would you say, is there any value to, you know, I kind of look at it like my mind's this, like a feedback loop, like whatever comes in is going to, you know, like especially sitting down for Sashin, I, you know, started watching this show on Netflix this about this biker gang, and now I got this stuff, hardcore stuff coming up in my zazen, you know. So
oh, man.
One aspect is like entertaining, and then on the other hand, it's like, you know, this isn't you know, the kind of stuff that I want to, you know, be creating. In my, you know, it's, to me it feels like wasted
yeah.
Information.
Well, it can be fun.
Yeah, so it was fun while watching it, but then it really hits home for me like how important it is to monitor what's coming into the sensory perception.
It's true. You know? It's true. That's what the Eightfold Path is about. Mm-hmm. And it's real simple. It's not this elaborate kind of full of, I don't know, rites and rituals. It's just how to carry our intention and find the right kind of work to do and do meditation and cultivate mindfulness. No, it's very simple. That was Buddha's advice. Just make a simple life.
Good advice.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, it's time.